Welcome to Courage Cocktail. I am your host, Leanne McClymont. I am so glad you are here today. Today's program, we are going to learn about bugs. Yep, you heard it here first. We're going to study bugs, but we're going to narrow our focus to a very specific form of bug, the cicadas. Many of our friends in the Northeast, and specifically the East Coast of North America, are experiencing the absolute emergence of the 17-year cicadas. We all hear about this in popular culture, but I figured we better address it head on and start learning, getting some facts. Fortunately, in our own backyard here in Raleigh, Durham, Carver, North Carolina, we have the North Carolina State University. I've invited Dr. Clyde Sorensen, a professor at NC State. He is a distinguished alumni undergraduate professor of entomology. Dr. Sorensen's points of interests are specifically the biology and management of arthropod pests and beneficials in tobacco, as well as the interactions between soil, water, and wildlife conservation practices and pest management in row crop culture. We've got Dr. Sorensen on the telephone, and we've gone ahead and started to organize a conversation about cicadas. I'd like to welcome you to the show, Dr. Sorensen.
How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks so much. I know you're a busy guy because it sounds like you're in the season of cicadas.
Yep, they've been coming out in North Carolina for about 2.5 weeks now, which is actually a little late compared to most years, but nonetheless, they're out in full force in most of the parts of North Carolina where they're going to emerge, and they're probably going to be with us for another couple weeks.
Well, I'd love you to help us learn a little bit more about this sometimes scary-looking bug. So I'm going to jump in and ask some simple questions.
Okay.
Are all these cicadas the same?
All right. So the ones that we're talking about today are actually special. They're quite special because the life cycles that we see in these seven species of cicadas only occur in eastern North America and no place else in the world. And the cicadas that we're talking about are the ones we call periodic cicadas. So there are, as I said, seven species of periodic cicadas. There are three species of 17-year cicadas and four species of 13-year cicadas. And the ones that are coming out this year, the ones that have become so notorious throughout much of eastern United States, are what we call the Brood 2 cicadas. So for 17 years, they've been sitting in the ground as immatures, feeding on the roots of trees. And this month is their one brief month in the sun after that 17 years in the clay.
Aww.
So the 17-year cicada species tend to be more northern in distribution. The 13-year cicadas tend to be more southern in distribution.
Well, all right. So now their month in the sun. What is that all about? Are they just trying to find a mate?
So the whole mission for the insects that are out right now is reproduction. That's their sole reason for being, is to make sure that 17 years from now there's another emergence of cicadas. So what generally happens is they emerge en masse. Each one, there are three species. Each one of those species emerges at a slightly different time, but all pretty much at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They crawl up out of the ground as a nymph. They find themselves someplace more or less vertical to shed. And they pop out of that that nymphal exoskeleton, and those are those dry husks that the folks that may be experiencing this emergence have been seeing all around the base of trees and whatnot. What crawls out of that dry husk is actually a pretty spectacular ghostly white creature with brilliant red eyes. It'll crawl up just a little bit further from where it emerged, and it'll spend the first night of its life expanding its wings, and then over the next several days it's going to completely harden its new exoskeleton, and it's going to change from that ghostly white creature to what I think as an entomologist is a really pretty black and orange creature with those same brilliant red ruby eyes.
Oh, those eyes are spectacular.
they're really cool. So after it emerges, after it finishes hardening its exoskeleton, after it completes its adult development, which takes 3 or 4 days, then the males will start calling. And each species has its own individual set of calls to communicate with other members of its species. And that's when the racket starts. And the males are making those calls to attract females and then to convince them that they're worthy mates. And the males will mate with as many females as they can. Once the females mate, then they generally set about the task of laying eggs. And they lay their eggs by sawing little tiny slits into new growth twigs on trees. And then they deposit those eggs in the slits so that the eggs are protected from predators or parasites. And what happens after that happens is that the twig from where they made that oviposition slit, from that point outward, the twig often dies, or Wilson dies, and so you see these little flagged twigs all over the trees, and that's another sign that the cicadas leave. And so they mate, they call, they mate, they lay their eggs, and then they die. And so their whole reason for being, this one brief month in the sun, is to make sure that next generation is there.
Well, it's an amazing story. And one of the things that came to my mind in the description is you mentioned that the female lays the eggs in a twig or in the trees, but you said that it's to avoid predators and pests. What kind of predators eat these things or threaten this form of life?
Well, okay, so that's one of the other really cool things about this bizarre 17-year life cycle. They all emerge en masse only once every 17 years. We think basically to swamp the predators that live in the vicinity. So, in other words, they come out in such huge numbers that all the predators, and when cicadas come up, almost all other animals become predators of cicadas. When they come up, there's simply so many of them that the predators can't eat all of them. And so in a given area, there are lots of birds that will eat cicadas, lots of mammals that will eat cicadas, including mice and raccoons and even deer will eat them, and lots of other insects that will attack them. But they just come out in such huge numbers that all those predators together really can't dent the population. We call that predator satiation or predator swamping as a strategy for negating the effects of predators. And we think that these 17 and 13-year life cycles have evolved to reduce the likelihood that predators, any particular predators, would be able to track their populations. 13 years and 17 years, those are both prime numbers. And so there are very few other kinds of life cycles, life cycle durations, that could overlap with those prime number, long prime number life cycles.
So that's called predator satiation or swamping. And
the
method here is that you're using math, or nature is using this large number, prime number 17 or 13, so that it's just out of whack with everyone else's, their predators' reproductive cycles, or however you want.
Right, exactly.
So it's out of phase, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
And it's
highly unlikely that any other natural enemy could tightly synchronize with the life cycle that long and that irregular in its occurrence.
Well, when somebody is interested in cicadas, you only get 17 years in your professional life to see them in action.
Well,
how does that work?
So, actually, if you were going to try and study them in one particular locale.
While we get Dr. Sorensen back on the line, he happened to be talking about the 17 and 13-year-old cycles that go between each one of these crops or generations of cicadas. And one of the things that we didn't realize until he spoke to us was the value of the prime number and how that places us out of phase with other predators. Dr. Sorensen, you're back on the line,
yep.
I hope.
I'm back.
Great.
I'm back.
Thank you. Listen, you were describing to me, or I asked you this question, and that is when you're studying cicadas, and this is where the line broke up, but I was concerned that you're only emerging for a month every 17 years, how on earth do you study these things?
Well, so if you were trying to study them in one particular location, that would be a problem because you only have once every 17 years to observe the adults. Of course, mm-hmm. you could study what's going on with the nymphs for the intervening 17 years, but you have to dig them out of the ground to do that. But what actually happens is that if you are willing to move geographically, more years than not, there are cicadas emerging someplace in the eastern United States. So there are 15 broods of periodic cicadas. Each one of these broods has more or less its own geographic distribution. And, for instance, in North Carolina, we have pieces of about 6 or maybe 7 broods of cicadas. So in North Carolina, 6 or 7 years out of a 17-year cycle, we can find cicadas someplace in the state. Now, some of those broods are much more extensive geographically than others. The brood that's emerging this year, the brood 2 of the 17-year cicadas, is one of the largest geographically. It extends from the Piedmont of North Carolina all the way up to southern New England. And some of the other broods are very restricted in geographic extent. But if you go across the entire eastern United States, there's only 3 or 4 years in a 20-year cycle where there aren't cicadas emerging someplace.
I get it. Okay, so I understand. Now, I have this question that we explained that it's the Piedmont all the way up to southern New England.
Right.
So these are brood 2. If it's a huge crop, if that's the right word to call this generation.
That's one way to refer to it, sure.
Well, wouldn't it have an impact on other life forms? For example, if there's a ton of great food for mice, wouldn't there be an increase in mice?
It's conceivable. One of the things that probably limits real population changes in some of those predators is that it's a very, very ephemeral resource. So they're really only available for 5 or 6 weeks. And most predators that exploit them have life cycles that are considerably longer than 5 or 6 weeks. So the ones that are fortunate to live in a place where cicadas are emerging are going to do quite well for a while the cicadas are up. And their reproductive success may be enhanced slightly because of that abundance of resources if their reproductive cycles are in sync with this emergence of this resource. But in practical terms, it probably doesn't have a whole lot of an impact on good or bad on the success of those animals that are exploiting this resource for that 5 or 6 weeks that it's available.
Well, it sounds like it's a very elegantly charted course, life cycle, that influences, that's just using all kinds of resources very intelligently. One last question before we move on to another topic of your life as an entomologist. When those lovely little eggs drop to the ground, they fall out down the twig, how deep do they go into the topsoil to survive these 17 years or 13 years, whatever the cycle?
So it's actually the nymphs, the tiny nymphs that emerge from those eggs are the ones that drop to the ground. Uh-huh. And that'll happen later this summer. They'll generally tunnel's not actually the right word, but they'll burrow into the soil somewhere in the vicinity of 18 to 20 inches deep into the soil. And they'll find themselves a tree root of an appropriate species, and they'll pretty much stay there. They may move over the ensuing 17 years. They may move in response to the health of that tree root or the growth of that tree root, but they'll pretty much stay in a fairly small area for the next 17 years. They'll molt 5 different times, but they basically make their living sucking the sap out of the roots of those trees. And as far as we can tell, for healthy forest trees, it really has no discernible impact on the health of the trees.
Is there anything that you know about, like, cicadas that would be able to help me understand why are they here?
Why are they here?
Yes.
So that's a question that entomologists get asked all the time about different insects. The most common one is mosquitoes. Why are they here? Mm-hmm. Well, they're here because there's an ecological niche that's open. Uh-huh. There's a resource that can be exploited if you adapt, if the organism evolves to exploit that resource. And so they're here because there are trees to feed on, basically.
Okay.
And they've evolved this life cycle to exploit that resource and to cope with all the natural enemies that can bear on the population. Now, there are other cicadas. But there are lots of cicadas all around the world. In fact, they're mm-hmm. it's a very speciose group. There are probably several thousand species of cicadas in the world. There are dozens of species in North Carolina. But most of these other cicadas have what we call them annual cicadas or dog day cicadas because some emerge every year. And so their strategy for dealing with predators is somewhat different. They're, instead of placing all their bets on one single emergence, some of them emerge every year, and even though they have life cycles longer than a year. And so their strategy is that, you know, some of us, even if this year lots of us get eaten, other years maybe some of us won't, and we'll still make it. Our species will still persist with this different strategy for coping with natural enemies. So in North Carolina, we see cicadas every year. Everybody sees, if they pay attention, sees or hears cicadas every year. Those are the dog day cicadas or annual cicadas that come out later in the summer and have this different strategy for coping with predators.
And it's a brilliant one because it always surprises me just how adaptive nature can be to support life. But speaking of adaptive, I need to understand something beyond the cicada. I'd like to learn more about your life as an entomologist. So many of our listeners tune in for a variety of reasons, considering, you know, solving vexing problems with new medicine. And one of those is learning new careers or unusual careers. And I'd like to know if you could teach us a little bit about how do you become an entomologist?
Well, my story, of course, everybody's story is more or less unique, but my story is that my background, my undergraduate background, was in wildlife biology here at North Carolina State.
Okay.
And while I was working on my undergraduate degree, and then shortly thereafter, I came to realize, because of exposures to a really neat course I took as a senior, that insects are wildlife, and in fact, in lots of important respects, they're probably the most important wildlife. And so they're certainly the most diverse creatures on the face of the planet. There's over a million species of insects that we've identified so far, and we're identifying new ones every day. And ecologically, economically, they're tremendously important. And so my general fascination with wildlife across the spectrum sort of focused a little more narrowly on insects. So how do I become an entomologist? Well, you go to school. And I got a master's degree in entomology, and then I pursued a PhD in entomology and completed that in 1988. We study, you know, that tremendous diversity. We study how insects function physiologically and behaviorally, and we put a lot of efforts into trying to understand how insects impact ecologically impact ecosystems and also economically impact us.
Yes, and I told our listeners when I read your, you know, a little bit of your bio, I noticed that you spend a lot of time studying about crops, something called row crops, and the effect of insects.
So row crops are the crops that we plant every year, mm-hmm. the annual crops that we plant every year. And over the course of my career, I've worked on a number of different crop systems. I've worked in alfalfa when I was employed by the University of Nevada, mm-hmm. and cotton and corn and soybeans and rice when I was employed by the University of Missouri, mm-hmm. in Columbia. In North Carolina, I've worked primarily on the insects that attack tobacco and some in cotton, soybeans, and some other crops. So insects are tremendous competitors with us for the crops that we grow. And the way we conduct agriculture today in this part of the world, in some respects, makes insects even better competitors for
Why
the crops
is that?
That we grow. Well, when we grow crops in large blocks, like most of the crop fields that you see when you drive around North Carolina or other parts of the United States, we farm in what we call monocultures. And monocultures, if you're an insect that's adapted to a particular crop, a 40 or 60 or 100-acre field of that crop is basically like discovering Valhalla, right? You have... You've discovered an unlimited resource, and if you're adapted to that crop, and by definition, most insects have very high reproductive potentials. If you manage to successfully find that crop, then you can exploit it very efficiently because basically that's the only resource that's in that field. And so when we grow things in monocultures, the insects that are adapted to those crops are enabled to exploit those crops extraordinarily effectively. And that means that we end up having a lot of times to do things to try and reduce the effects of those insects. Otherwise, we're growing crops for them and not us. And, of course, the reason we're growing them is for us.
That's right. And so you're talking about using insecticides or using techniques that make it less possible for them to thrive?
Right. So insecticides are just one tool. Over the last 40 years, my field has developed a philosophy of pest control that, in fact, we don't like to use the word control anymore. We like to use the word management. And so our management of those pests that attack crop plants, we like to achieve through a strategy called integrated pest management. And in integrated pest management, we try and bring to bear all the different kinds of tools we might be able to exploit to reduce the impact of insects. And insecticides end up being our tool of last resort. So we rely on cultural strategies like when do you plant, when do you harvest, how far apart do you make your rows, do you rotate from one field to another. We use things like biological control. The natural enemies that I was just talking about with regard to the cicadas can be very important tools for helping to reduce pest populations in a crop field. We use sometimes mechanical control strategies or physical control strategies. Host plant resistance, where we breed crop plants that can protect themselves to some extent or another against particular pests. So we try and bring to bear all these tools. And if all those other tools are not getting the job done to an economically satisfactory standard, then we'll use insecticides as a tool of last resort.
Well, you know, I listen to this, and it's equally an elegant approach because you're using all the natural tools that you have laid out in the proper order sequentially. So this does certainly it helps me understand how complex this stuff can be. But when I think about the work that you're doing, I can't help but wonder, you study the lives of insects, and I recognize you do, you know, a lot of stuff. But one question that keeps on emerging in our friends out here in Carrboro, North Carolina, mm-hmm. is what is earth going on with the bees? Is there anything that you know about the bees that can help us understand what's going on?
Well, that's a huge question that lots of people would like an answer to, and mm-hmm. and the bottom line is that we don't know for sure yet exactly what is causing the problems that many people are observing with honeybees. one thing that's important to remember when we talk about honeybees is that, as far as North America is concerned, is they're not native. They're not native to North America. They're actually a Eurasian and African species that were introduced here back pretty much as soon as Europeans found the continent. But the bottom line is that, as far as we can tell, there are a whole lot of different things that are putting pressure on bee populations, and these different phenomena in concert are probably the explanation for the decline in honeybees. And that's not at all satisfactory. Most people, you know, they want to find the bad guy. Yeah. They want to take the silver bullet and aim it at the bad guy and fix the problem. And unfortunately, with honeybees, it's not going to be that simple. So there are diseases that have become very problematic for many beekeepers. Mm-hmm. There are a couple parasitic mites that are hugely important. And these two parasitic mites largely account for the disappearance of wild feral honeybee colonies throughout most of North America before the colony collapse thing ever really reared its head. On top of that, many commercial beekeepers, particularly those who are marketing the pollination services of their bees, manage their bee colonies very intensively and move them frequently. And lots of these kinds of activities can have negative impacts on bees. Sure. And then there is a possibility that some of the insecticides that we're using may be negatively and indirectly affecting the bees as well. So the problem is it's not a simple, clear-cut issue, and so the solutions are not going to be simple and clear-cut.
Which really either. Brings us right back to the centerpiece of your work, which is this insect management, using all the tools that you have, with the consideration of insecticide at the last piece, as the final tool.
Right.
But if I'm allowed to, I know you're a busy guy, but I have a question. It's telescoping out again, and that mm-hmm. is this. So much of science and popular culture now are mixing. And the reason I think this is that the Scientific Americans blog is always asking people to go out there and try to collect information about X. How do you think that this whole crowdsourcing of problems, particularly in the study of entomology, could help us understand the dimensions of problems and perhaps find some solutions?
There are a lot of really tremendous potential activities that interested people could help entomologists address. I have a colleague in another department who is using citizen science to try and understand what's going on with ants. Lots of ant species are exotic. Lots of ant species are native. And he's harnessing the power of citizen science, if you will, to try and understand what's going on with ant population dynamics, particularly in relation to, the altered habitats that we live in, the environments that we construct for ourselves. Similarly, there's a tremendous potential for citizen scientists to help us understand the scope of the diversity of insects. So in North Carolina, we don't know for sure how many species of insects there are in this state. We know that there are somewhere in the neighborhood of about 400 or so bird species that have been recorded, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 55 or 60 or maybe 75 species of reptiles and amphibians. But we have no real good understanding of exactly how many species of insects occur here.
I can imagine why, because the population dynamics, just the diversity itself, there aren't enough of you guys to go out there and find these things.
Well, that's exactly right. And, we think that we're in the ballpark of 12,000 maybe species of insects, but nobody really has any good grasp on that. If you ask a herpetologist, he can tell you exactly how many species of reptiles and amphibians have been recorded in North Carolina.
Really?
And similarly, if you ask an ornithologist.
Yeah.
But you can't ask any entomologist in this state and get a straight answer to that question. There are, you know, some people who have particular interests in particular groups of insects that could contribute tremendously to our understanding of the diversity of insects in North Carolina. I have a friend who lives up in the mountains who has developed a very, very intense interest in moths. And lots of people think of moths as these little dusty things that flutter around your lights at night. But if you actually look closely at even the small ones, you'll find that some of them are just dramatically spectacular creatures if you look at them close enough. And he, in one summer, identified about 680 species of moths on his one property up in the mountains. So, you know, somebody doing that kind of work and carefully cataloging what they're finding could make a significant contribution to understanding of, say, the diversity, in that case, of moths in the northwestern corner of North Carolina. So I think there's a tremendous potential. And the advance of the Internet and all the resources that opens to people, I think, you know, we're going to figure out ways in the coming years to really harness the energy of people who have interest in things that we have interest in.
That's right. And I, you know, I appreciate your straight up answers here, because, you know, not knowing is such a reasonable answer. And when I talk about this stuff with friends all over the East Coast, you know, one of the connecting points for our culture between our, you know, our friends up in New York, our friends down here in North Carolina, is that we all are celebrating the emergence of the cicadas.
Right.
And I do see crowdsourcing as a new tool, if you will, for solving our problems for the next generations, perhaps. I'm not sure if I'll be living here long enough to understand its full power, but I suspect it's a dynamo. So I want to thank you, and I want to shout out again. We've had the privilege of joining Dr. Clyde Sorensen joining us at NC State. It's a privilege that you shared your knowledge and insight with us. I want to thank you.
I was glad to do it. Thank you very much for asking me to visit with you.
All righty. Well, we'll point more people over to NC State. If you're interested in bugs, guys, listeners, go out to their website at NC State University, and you will be blown away by the richness of their Department of Entomology. Thanks a lot, Dr. Sorensen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Cicadas are invading in 2013, hatching and chillaxing on everything they see, on the plants, on the leaves. Their beady red eyes keep staring at me. They've been growing underground for 17 years, waiting patiently to buzz in our ears like a Hitchcock movie from your worst fears. Close your mouths, cover your ears. I'm so sick of cicadas, a little freaked out, a little afraid. I know that cicadas, yuck. Ew. They crunch under your feet, they fly in your hair, fall from the trees, they're a total nightmare.
Oh my gosh, they're everywhere.
I'm so sick of cicadas, a little freaked out, a little afraid. I know they're not as bad as Al-Qaeda, but I still kind. But I still kinda hate them. I'm so sick of cicadas. Makes me wanna take a vacation, pack up the kids and go to Grenada. And I'm so sick.
I hope you enjoyed that little song. I had to pull that out after speaking to Dr. Clyde Sorensen. You were listening to a Nashville artist called Kathy Ashworth, and she created the song back in 2011 in preparation of the cicadas. And we wanted to thank Dr. Sorensen for joining us. We're going to get a little bit of break, and when we return, we are going to talk about more about cicadas, more about the things that we will be hearing at nighttime, at summertime, all over the northeast coast, of course, or southeast as well. And we've got a little game on cue. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute.
WCOM, your all-community radio station, in Carrboro, North Carolina, needs your support. Do you have an idea for a radio show? How about an interest in engineering or a computer background? Are you interested in fundraising or just meeting a group of wonderful people? Please consider a donation of time or money to support this gem of the community. To find out more, please check out our website, www.wcomfm.org. Again, www.wcomfm.org.
Welcome back to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. You are listening to WCOM LPFM 103.5 here in Carrboro, North Carolina. This morning, we had decided to do a program about bugs. Well, a very specific form of bug, actually, cicadas. And friends, those among us living on the east coast of the North American continent, we are being inundated for the next 6 weeks with the emergence of cicadas. Actually, they're beautiful things. This Mother Nature is an elegant source of inspiration for me and for most of us. But I wanted to spend some time on the second half of our program, opening and tuning in your own ears. That's right. It's summertime. When we go out for the walks at nighttime, we hear an abundance of beautiful things. Cicadas, those creatures come out during the day, and you can hear them. But other sounds of crickets, grasshoppers, everything occurs at night. So I wanted to take the opportunity today to tune in some ears. I'd like to talk a little bit about a few special kinds of bugs. Most of my information came from a wonderful website called www.discoverlife.org. There are things that you're going to hear, and many of them are very common. The ground crickets. These are tiny little crickets that make a tiny chirring sounds in the grass. Those are different than tree crickets. These make very sweet choruses that call from shrubs and low vegetation. There are a couple of other things I'd like to talk to you about and talk about their sounds. Something called the northern mole cricket. It's a cricket from wetlands and wet meadows. It's got a very distinctive frog-like call that gives over and over and over again. It might be interesting for you to listen to this. The other object, the other animal or insect that makes sounds is called a cone-head katydids. Indeed, they do have cone heads, and they give these very loud buzzing sounds. They lack tonality, and in many people's opinions, it sounds more like white noise. Many of these folks are little insects hang out in the tall grass. Lastly, I want to talk about something called a meadow katydid, another group that hangs out in tall grasses. These species are great tests for your hearing. Most have very high-pitched calls and are a combination of ticks and gentle buzzes. They often sound like a lawn sprinkler. Now, I know many of you are out there saying, Leanne, help me out. What are the differences between crickets, katydids, and cicadas? The simplest answer that I could find for you is that crickets and katydids largely call out at night, while cicadas are almost entirely call out during the daytime. Crickets are sweet-sounding and musical, while katydids and cicadas are buzzy, they're raspy, and they're a little bit on the harsh-sounding side. Biologically, crickets and katydids are closely related, while cicadas come out from an entirely different order of insects. But we've had the expert on earlier at this program to help us learn more about that. What I'd like to do with you folks now is to play a game. I'm going to call this my version of Name That Tune. With my competent engineer over here, Bill, we are going to play six little tracks, and each one we will play three times. The first twice, I'm going to listen and ask you to listen along with me. And after the second play, I'm going to tell you what it is. But I want you to guess. In the meantime, so I'm going to play this track twice. Then I'm going to tell you what the sound is, and we'll return to it to help you identify when you're out on your walk sometime this summertime. You'll be able to identify the sounds you're hearing. So let's start with the first cue. We're going to play that piece for you one more time. How many of you guessed what that was? That's called a tinkling ground cricket. And you could hear it's a little bit musical. I love that sound. I'm going to play it one more time. Listen to the tinkling ground cricket. Now, next on cue, we're going to play this little piece for you. Go right ahead, Bill. Can you guess what kind of an insect that is? Let's listen to it one more time. Listeners, that we were listening is a Japanese burrowing cricket. Can you hear the song of the cricket? Let's listen to this Japanese burrowing cricket. How are you doing? Are you getting any of these crickets right? I have a next track up. I'm pretty sure you'll be able to identify what species it is. We're going to listen to that one more time. I have a feeling by now, by the third passage, you would have guessed that was a cricket. This is called the April Chirper, and we're going to listen to the April Chirper song one more time. Now, listeners, we're going to move into a different insect. This one coming up is going to sound very different to you. Let's listen. It certainly sounds different than the cricket, doesn't it? Let's listen to it one more time. Well, you could have heard it's certainly not a cricket. That didn't sound very musical. That's a katydid. It's called a common true katydid. And for me, when I hear this sound, I think of nighttime. Could we play it one more time? I hope you've enjoyed that, katydid. We are moving now. We have brought six voices with me. Those were the first four voices. Coming right along is another insect. And believe me, this one might be a little scary sounding. We've got to listen to that again. You've got to believe me. It might sound like a lawnmower. It is a real insect. Take a close listen and take a wild guess as to what it might be. You may not believe this, but that's the sound of a common field grasshopper. I want to call it a grass chopper because it actually sounds like a lawnmower or a helicopter. Take a close listen so that when you hear it again outside, you'll be able to identify what you're hearing. Well, we've had five. I've got one more voice to share with you. It is not a grasshopper. It's not a katydid. It's not a cricket. This sound is something we probably don't want to hear. We're going to try it one more time. Listeners, that is the raspy sound of a locust. I had to add that at the end to draw a beautiful comparison between the sweet sounds of those crickets and the sound of a locust. Let's listen to it one final time. I hope you enjoyed that. You know, when we bring in voices of nature, so many of these nature sounds are sound escapes that play all at the same time. Particularly, of course, as we now know, katydids and, of course, crickets. They come out at night. So I'm hoping that this little lesson and this little game might intrigue you enough to bring out your family, go out into those woods, and listen to the wonderful sounds of nature, particularly those that are here in the summer, early parts of summer. As we are moving towards the end of our show, I wanted to say thank you to our sponsor, the Triangle Swim School. You can learn more about them at www.triangleswimschool.com. We also want to give you a heads up. We're having a wonderful couple of programs coming in for early June. We decided to take a little bit closer look in the summertime of particularly new hobbies. Things that may not always get your attention. One of them, of course, that we have a very active society called the Triangle Bonsai Society. They will be joining us on June 19th. We're also doing a program all about orchids, the Triangle Orchid Society. We suspect that date will be in June 26th, but stay posted on our Facebook page for more details. Next week, we're running a program. Again, we have a wonderful example with Dr. Greg Chapman from NC State, and I've invited him on the show to talk to us about food safety. Now, don't worry, this is not a North Carolina-centric program, far from it. This program is going to be all about what do we need to watch out for? Our gardens, we're planting gardens, how do we keep our foods healthy? Safe from airborne pathogens. How do we keep our food safe and therefore our family safe? I expect that it will be a very important show as across the country all of our crops are coming in, and that means our home gardens are flourishing, hopefully. So we've got one final gift for you today. You know, cicadas may sound ugly. The words, the sounds, I think they're beautiful, but I think bugs are great. But I found a wonderful piece of poetry I wanted to share with you. It's called Cicadas at the End of Summer. It was written by Martin Wallace. Whine as they though, a pine tree is bowing a broken violin, as though a bandsaw cleaves a thousand thin sheets of titanium. They chime like freight wheels on a Norfolk Southern slowing into town. But all you ever see is the silence. Husks glued to the underside of maple leaves with their 1950s Bakelite lines, they do just as well hanging from a ceiling of a space museum. What cicadas leave behind is a kind of crystallized memory, the stubborn detail of that shape around a life turned, the color of forgotten things, a cold broth of tea and milk in the bottom of a mug, or a skin on an old tin of varnish you have to lift with lineman's pliers, a flypaper that hung 30 years in Bird's Copper's pantry in Brighton. I hope you enjoyed today's program. I'm thrilled to be with you here at WCOM LPFM. You bring the lunch, and I'll bring the courage cocktail.